Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 255 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I want to talk about a subject that seems to have been giving people quite a number of issues on Step 2CK in recent times. At least people seem to be worried about mechanism of action questions. People are like, ooh, mechanism of action. So I figured I'd make like a podcast or two, you know, or maybe like a few podcasts here and there, where I talk about like the major drugs and the key things that the USMLE will probably go after with those drugs. This is targeted specifically to those that are taking step 2CK or step 3. If you want an in-depth treatment of pharmacology, I've pretty much covered all the pharmacology in first aid in different podcasts, but check under the step 1 tab on the spreadsheet that I highlight on my website. And then just as a reminder, if you're taking step 2CK, I do have a course coming up this Saturday on the 22nd of August. I also have another one coming up on the 5th of September. And then I have a two-day option, right? So remember the 22nd of August one is a 10-hour class. It's 10 hours, one day. And we basically review like 600 or 800 concepts from like... from IM, PEDS, surgery, neuro, OB-GYN, psych. And it's over a 10-hour period. We start at 6 a.m. Pacific time, go from 6 to 10 a.m. Pacific, take a 2-hour break, noon to 4 p.m. Pacific, take a 2-hour break, and then 6 to 8 p.m. Pacific, and then we're done. And again, many people have found this course to be pretty helpful. And again, I think of the course as software. I update it very regularly, very, very regularly. To meet the needs of the newer exam. Again, just trying to stay in tune with the MBME and the way they test things. And most of these things I discuss them in the context of a clinical vignette. And then, if you want to know how to take these tests and take them successfully, I'm offering a test-taking strategies course. It's going to be on the 10th of September. It's going to be on the 10th of September. I made my most recent podcast, like the podcast before this episode 254. I kind of talk about the times and stuff. So if you want to have all your questions answered, listen to that podcast. It's very short. It will put you through on all these things. So, you know, I have a bunch of courses basically coming up over the next couple of weeks because I know that ERAS is popping up on the 21st of October. So there's a ton of people taking exams this period. Okay. So let me just go, and if you want to sign up for these courses, just basically fill out like the contact form on my website and just reach out to me, and then I'll give you some more information. But again, I feel like most questions that people email me about, I pretty much answer them in the podcast. So just listen to episode 254. It will just save us from having to like go back and forth over email on something that I've already clearly described in a podcast. Okay. So, and again, this will be a freestyle discussion. It'll be a freestyle discussion. But again, I'll try to hit on most of the major drugs. Again, I will try not to make this podcast super long. Okay. So let's talk about the blood drugs, right? That's probably like a good place to start, right? So, you know, the blood drugs, there are essentially two big categories here, right? There's the antiplatelet agents and there's the anticoagulants, right? Again, remember, the antiplatelet agents, they're not the same thing as anticoagulants. And for the most part on MBME exams, what do we use antiplatelet agents for? We use them for things like if a person has a stroke or a TIA, right, like carotid stenosis, we give those people antiplatelet agents, right? Like first line, if a person has carotid stenosis, the first line drug is always going to be aspirin. If you don't see that as an answer, the second line drug you should go for is clopidogrel. If you don't see that as an answer, the third line drug you should go for is dipyridamole, right? And I'll talk about the mechanisms of actions of these drugs, right? Another region on MBME exams where we use antiplatelet agents, right? If you notice, I kind of have like a fairly different focus with discussing these drugs. Another thing you may see on MBME exams with these antiplatelet agents is if a person has peripheral arterial disease. If a person has peripheral arterial disease, those people need to take an antiplatelet agent, basically like aspirin for life, right? Another group that also gets this is if a person, for example, has percutaneous coronary intervention, right, for like a myocardial infarction, those people are usually placed on some kind of dual antiplatelet therapy, right, for, you know, a couple of months after they get the stent. And obviously, if a person is having an MI, right, I would hope that you're giving them an aspirin at the very beginning, right, like, you know, when they come in for therapy, that's the first drug you should always give any person that presents with chest pain on an MBME exam, right? You give them aspirin. right? And then remember, we also use aspirin, right, for Kawasaki's disease, right? It's one of those things we give. We give aspirin plus IVIG for Kawasaki's disease. And then finally, if a woman has had preeclampsia or a previous pregnancy and you're like, you know what? I don't want you getting preeclampsia or a later pregnancy. Go ahead and give that woman aspirin. Aspirin is actually pretty good prophylaxis. I guess while we're on it, if you see a woman that has had like, if you see a woman that has had, what's the cervical thing? Cervical insufficiency, right? Cervical insufficiency, you can prevent it in future pregnancies by giving her progestin suppositories, right? So let's talk about these antiplatelet agents, right? So what are the key things with these antiplatelet agents, right? So we know that the platelet cascade, right? There's primary hemostasis, there's secondary hemostasis, right? So primary hemostasis, what happens in primary hemostasis? First thing we do is we have this adhesion step, right? You know, GP1B binds to von Willebrand factor, right? You have that adhesion step. When those two things couple together, right, you then begin to eject the ton of ADP from the platelet. The ADP from the platelet will bind to an ADP receptor. Remember, that ADP receptor is also known as the P2Y12 receptor, right? When ADP binds to that receptor, it's a G protein coupled receptor, right? It will trigger some kind of signaling cascade that will then cause you to make a ton of GP2B3A, okay? GP2B3A. And then that GP2B3A will bind with another GP2B3A from another platelet, right? And that will be the aggregation step. So first step is adhesion with GP1B binding to von Willebrand factor. Second step is the activation step where you're releasing a lot of ADP from the platelet that will act on ADP receptors on that same platelet. And then the third step is the aggregation step, right? Where again, GP2B3A is kind of coexist, bind to each other to form that platelet plug, right? So what are some key things you want to know here, right? You want to know that aspirin is a COX inhibitor, right? Aspirin is a COX inhibitor. Aspirin inhibits cyclooxygenase. It inhibits COX 1 and 2. It's irreversible compared to all the other NSAIDs that are reversible inhibitors of COX 1 and COX 2, right? And by inhibiting the production of cyclooxygenase, right, you're not going to make thromboxane A2. If you don't make TXA2, then you're not going to be able to have that aggregation step. You're inhibiting the aggregation step of primary hemostasis because TXA2 actually helps with platelet aggregation, right? That's one high-yield thing to know for exams. Second high-yield thing you want to know with these agents, right? Remember, like, we have these GP2B3 inhibitors, right? So things like apixaban, right? Eptifibatide, tirofiban, right? Apixaban is probably the big one you see on a test, right? It's a GP2B3 inhibitor. By doing that, right, basically you're preventing one GP2B3 from binding to another GP2B3, so you don't form the primary platelet plug, right? And then if you go down this P2Y12 receptor business, right, remember drugs like clopidogrel, prasugrel, ticagrelor, right? Those are ADP receptor antagonists, P2Y12 blockers, right? Because if you block that receptor, then ADP won't bind to it and you will not activate the platelet, right? And then in terms of these drugs like dipyridamol, celostazol, those are actually antiplatelet agents, but they are not classically used for platelet problems, right? So like celostazol, for example, on MBM exams, is one of those things you give after you've tried a supervised exercise program for a person that has peripheral arterial disease. If that's not cutting it, you can add celostazol, right? Dipyridamol, on the other hand, is one of those things that I use for pharmacological stress tests, right? Again, if you notice, you may be like, Divine, but I have the Sankey card that said this and this and this and this and this. Again, this is a targeted review for pharmacology for who? People taking step 2 CK and step 3. Basically, I'm trying to give you the information that you need to get these questions right, right? So dipyridamol, again, is used for pharmacological stress tests. Celostazol is used to treat peripheral arterial disease after you've tried a supervised exercise program, right? So how do those drugs work? So the thing is, these drugs, they are phosphodiesterase 3 inhibitors. They inhibit PDE3. When you inhibit phosphodiesterase 3, that will actually increase the amount of cyclic AMP. When there are high levels of cyclic AMP inside a cell, that actually, inside a platelet, that actually inhibits that signaling cascade downstream of the P2Y12 receptor. Because the P2Y12 receptor, believe it or not, it's actually an inhibitory G protein coupled receptor. So when ADP binds to it, because it's an inhibitory receptor, that will cut down on the production of cyclic AMP, right? And that will then cause activation of the platelet. So less cyclic AMP equals more platelet activation, right? So if you inhibit phosphodiesterase 3, remember PDE3 breaks down cyclic AMP. So if you inhibit it, cyclic AMP will build up. More cyclic AMP, less platelet activation, right? Less platelet activation. And some of you may be like, Divine, why would celostazole do squat for me if a person has peripheral arterial disease? Well, think about it, right? Remember, cyclic AMP, when it's low, that actually causes smooth muscles to relax, right? When cyclic AMP is high, that actually causes smooth muscles to relax. I'll say that again. When cyclic AMP is high, it causes smooth muscles to relax, right? Remember, cyclic AMP does different things in different kinds of muscles. When it's in cardiac muscle, high cyclic AMP causes increased contraction. But when it's smooth muscle, increased cyclic AMP actually causes muscle relaxation. So if you relax smooth muscle, that means you'll cause a blood vessel dilation, right? So you feed more blood to the legs, right? So that's a higher thing to know with those drugs. So those are the key mechanisms of action with those things. And then don't forget that if a person is on theophylline, right, then dipyridamole will probably not work, right? Or, you know, like adenosine will probably not work in those people, right? So remember, you use adenosine for pharmacological stress tests. You can also use dipyridamole for pharmacological stress tests. Why would that be the case? One, adenosine is a vasodilator, right? But the thing is, dipyridamole actually boosts your levels of adenosine. Dipyridamole is an adenosine deaminase inhibitor. So if you inhibit adenosine deaminase, adenosine will build up, right? And if it builds up, right, that will cause vasodilation. Remember, theophylline antagonizes the actions of adenosine, right? So, like, they can probably give you like a question about a person that has like COPD or really bad asthma that's being treated with theophylline, right? And then you notice that we're giving this person adenosine for an SVT and they're not doing well, right? If you see that, right, then you should already begin to imagine that this person is taking some drug that antagonizes the actions of adenosine, like theophylline, right? Now, if we're going to secondary hemostasis, the big things you want to know about these drugs, right? So let me kind of talk you through the key things, right? So warfarin is a big time drug, right? What are the things you would see on step 2CK with regards to warfarin? If a person has a prosthetic heart valve, they need warfarin, right? If a person has a prosthetic heart valve, they need warfarin. And remember, warfarin, how does it work? It inhibits vitamin K epoxide reductase, right? If you inhibit vitamin K epoxide reductase, you will not be able to gamma carboxylate factors 2, 7, 9, and 10 and protein CNS, right? But remember that before you start a person on warfarin, you need to bridge them with heparin. And how does heparin work? Heparin activates antithrombin 3. If you activate antithrombin 3, then you'll be able to inhibit factors 10 and factor 2, right? Because remember, factors 2, 7, 9, and 10 and protein CNS, those things actually pro-coagulable, but 2, 7, 9, and 10, if you inhibit, let me put it this way. Protein CNS, those are anticoagulants, like natural anticoagulants in the body. 2, 7, 9, and 10, those things promote coagulation. But the thing is, protein CNS, they have a shorter half-life than 2, 7, 9, and 10. So when you give a person warfarin and you inhibit vitamin K epoxide reductase, CNS, which are natural anticoagulants, will fall out of circulation first, while 2, 7, 9, and 10, they are still living on for like a few more days, right? So there's a temporary hypercoagulable state when a person is placed on warfarin. That's why you have to start heparin first before you bridge them to warfarin, right? Now, what do we use warfarin for? Again, I said we use warfarin for people that have prosthetic heart valves, right? Remember, the target INR there is 2.5 to 3.5, right? Second, we use warfarin in people that have AFib from a valvular cause. So let's say you have a person that has like mitral stenosis as their cause of AFib. You need to put those people on warfarin, right? You need to put those people on warfarin. And remember that warfarin is a teratogen, right? So you don't want to give it to a pregnant woman, right? Don't want to give it to a pregnant woman. And if a person is like super therapeutic on warfarin, what are some bad things that can happen? Well, they can have like a duodenal hematoma, right? That can present as like a small bowel obstruction, right? Or they can have like a rectus sheath hematoma, right? Or those people can have an intracranial bleed. Those are all things you want to keep at the back of your mind on exams. And obviously, if a person is on warfarin, it doesn't seem like a very good idea to give them TPA, right? It's only if you want them to bleed out and die, right? That's probably not an ideal thing to do, right? And if a person, you know, just has a super therapeutic INR, let's say it's like 6 or 7 for whatever reason, but they are not bleeding anywhere, they are normal, right? Go ahead and stop the warfarin. If they really want you to do anything for those people, you can give them like oral vitamin K. But if for some reason the person is like bleeding out, and you want to reverse that warfarin, you reverse warfarin these days with 4FPCC, the four-factor prothrombin complex concentrate, right? And then heparin, right? Remember, you reverse heparin with protamine sulfate, right? Reverse heparin with protamine sulfate. And again, remember, heparin is an activator of antithrombin 3, right? Which causes it to inhibit factor 10 and 2. Low molecular weight heparin, on the other hand, right? It also activates antithrombin 3, but it activates it to only inhibit factor 10, right? It activates it to only inhibit factor 10. And then remember, as we're talking about, the first group of drugs I talked about were antiplatelet drugs. Anticoagulants are warfarin, heparin, the factor 10 inhibitors. Remember, the factor 10 inhibitors all have XA in their name. Apixaban, edoxaban, rivaroxaban, right? So those drugs, right, they all inhibit factor 10, right? And then we have the factor 2 inhibitors, right? We have things like dabigatran, bivalirudin, agatroban, right? So I'll say that again. Agatroban, bivalirudin, dabigatran, right? Those are all factor 2 inhibitors. Those are all factor 2 inhibitors, right? And remember that the classic situation where you give people these drugs on exams is if a person, for example, has HET, right? So they give you a person, came in for surgery, got like low molecular weight heparin or heparin, and then you notice they give you two sets of labs and you notice that your platelet count has tanked, right? Like 5 days later, like dropped by like more than 50%. That's easy. That's HET. If a person has HET, stop the heparin product. Do not start them on low molecular weight heparin. That'll be an absurd thing to do. Start them on a factor 2 inhibitor, like bivalirudin, dabigatran, or agatroban. And remember that classically, the classic teaching is, oh, we can reverse warfarin. Oh, we can reverse heparin. But we cannot reverse any other drug, any other anticoagulant. That's not true. Dabigatran is now reversible, right? There's a monoclonal antibody known as idarucizumab. I'll say that again. Idarucizumab, idarucizumab. It's a monoclonal antibody against the dabigatran, right? So dabigatran is reversible these days on MBM exams. So I think those are the things I'm going to say with the blood drugs, right? So let me maybe take a quick dive into some of these cardio drugs, right? So what are the big things with the cardio drugs? Let's start with the ACE inhibitors, right? They all end in pril, like sinopril, enalapril, fosinopril, stuff like that. How do those things work, right? Those things, they inhibit angiotensin-converting enzyme, right? And if they ask for the site of action of these drugs, it's in the pulmonary capillaries. They work at the endothelial cells of the pulmonary capillaries, right? Now, what do we use ACE inhibitors for in exams, right? Again, ACE inhibitors, if you don't know about them, you're kind of asking for it on a test, right? So what do ACE inhibitors work for in MBM exams? It's, again, especially step 2 CK and step 3, right? We use them in people that have diabetes, right? So that their kidneys don't fall apart, right? We use them, and remember that ACE inhibitor story about how they are good for diabetics. The mechanism behind that is actually something that's high yield to know. Listen to the recent podcast I made on Starling forces. That will very quickly point out those high yield things to you, right? But basically, right, like ACE inhibitors, we use them to make people that have diabetes, we don't want their kidneys falling apart. If a person has heart failure, right, and we want to improve survival, ACE inhibitors are awesome for that. Remember the other drugs that improve survival in heart failure, beta blockers, right? ARBs, right? Angiotensin receptor blockers, right? Those aldosterone receptor antagonists, right, like spironolactone, right, and eplerenone. Although remember, spironolactone is also an androgen receptor blocker, so it causes guys to have boobies, right? So like gynecomastia. But eplerenone does not have that side effect, right? And then remember, if a person is an African American, right? So let's say person is African American, you can actually give them the combination of hydralazine and isosorbidinitrate, right? That actually improves survival in that population. And then there's also this thing known as a cardiac resynchronization therapy. Basically, on MBM, this is like a newer MBME concept, but basically if a person has heart failure, their EF is less than 35%, and they're on maximal medical therapy. So let's say you put them on ACE inhibitors, Bidil, blah, 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 everything, right? One thing you can actually do is, especially if the person has white QRS, you can actually do this thing where you put an ICD and then also perform something called cardiac resynchronization therapy. It has actually been shown to improve survival in some people with heart failure, especially this population I just described, EF less than 35%. And then, so what drug was I talking about? I was talking about ACE inhibitors, right? So we said again, diabetics, so their kidneys don't fall apart, people that have heart failure. And I don't know if for heart failure I mentioned beta blockers. If I did not, beta blockers, right? Remember, like metoprolol, carvedilol, bisoprolol, those things actually improve survival in heart failure, right? So again, ACE inhibitors, right? Diabetics, so their kidneys don't fall apart, improve survival in heart failure, right? Contraindicated in people that have bilateral renal artery stenosis, right? So how does show up on a test? They'll give you a question about a person. Oh, person has hypertension. You put them on an ACE inhibitor. Their creatinine was fine when they were started on said ACE inhibitor. You're like, wait, come back for a checkup 2 months from now. You look at their creatinine, you're like, whoa. How do your creatinine get to like 3, right? Those people have bilateral renal artery stenosis. Usually for those people, go ahead and do some kind of angiography of their kidneys, right? And figure out what in the world is going on with those people's kidneys, right? So just figure out basically the renal artery stenosis that they have, right? And then remember, if a person is being treated for a CHF exacerbation, and you've given them like furosemide, you've given them like a loop diuretic, you know, to try to kind of help their kidneys, try to help them with that fluid so they can get rid of that fluid. If you notice that all their fluid is not going out and you want to go ahead and add in a drug, add an ACE inhibitor, right? Because an ACE inhibitor will serve two roles. One, it's a diuretic, but two, the hyperkalemia associated with taking an ACE inhibitor will counterbalance the hypokalemia that's associated with a person taking a loop diuretic, right? For heart failure, right? And then what else do we use ACE inhibitors for? If a person, for example, has peripheral edema from taking like a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker, ACE inhibitors are the drugs of choice there. Again, the mechanism behind that, I discussed that in my Starling for CISA podcast. It's one of those episodes in the 250s. Okay, what else do we use ACE inhibitors for? Scleroderma renal crisis. If a person has scleroderma renal crisis and their creatinine is kind of like falafeling all over the place, go ahead and give those people an ACE inhibitor. It's actually the drug of choice for treating scleroderma renal crisis. Remember, if a person has scleroderma renal, like scleroderma, steroids are never the right answer ever for scleroderma. Okay. Now, is there any other thing I want to say with ACE inhibitors? Oh, they are teratogens, right? So don't give them to a pregnant woman. That would not be good, right? They can give you a question about a pregnant woman, you know, loss to follow-up, taking ACE inhibitors for hypertension, and then they tell you that her child, like she has oligohydramnios, right? That's pretty classic, right? Like, she took ACE inhibitors, crushed the child's kidneys, child basically has like Potter-style problems, not making urine, that'll present as oligohydramnios, right? So it can be like, oh, the amniotic fluid index is like 2, like some astronomically low number, right? Those are always, they can test those things. And obviously, ACE inhibitors can cause a dry cough, right? From an increase in bradykinin, right? And also, if a person has like a C1 esterase inhibitor deficiency, right? Those people should not be placed on ACE inhibitors, right? And also, do not forget, if a person has that dry cough from ACE inhibitors, go ahead and give them an ARB, right? Things that end in sartan, losartan, candesartan, telmisartan, right? So those are big things there, right? And then again, aldosterone receptor antagonists, what do we use those for, right? So we use those for, again, one, improving survival in heart failure, right? They work by blocking aldosterone receptors, right? Remember, those are an example of a potassium-sparing diuretic, right? So they cause hyperkalemia as a side effect, right? And then remember that spironolactone, you can actually use it to treat the hirsutism associated with PCOS on a test, right? You can use it to treat the hirsutism associated with PCOS on a test. And then don't forget that these aldosterone antagonists, you know, you can use them as to decrease portal pressures, right? You can actually use them to decrease portal pressures. So if a person has like a history of like esophageal varices, this is not what you give acutely, but you can give it chronically to reduce portal pressures. Spironolactone can actually be helpful for those purposes. Okay. And one other thing you may see spironolactone being used for is Kahn syndrome, right? Especially when a person has bilateral adrenal hyperplasia as the cause of their Kahn syndrome. Spironolactone or eplerenone is actually pretty good for those people. And again, as I said, spironolactone being an aldosterone receptor antagonist improves survival in heart failure, right? And then if we're going to the beta blockers, right? We use beta blockers for many things. Hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, improves survival in heart failure. We use them for migraines, especially like propranolol, right? Remember, we use them to treat akathisia, right? Akathisia, one of those extrapyramidal side effects from, you know, the tuberian fundibular pathway not working very well. We use propranolol for that. Performance anxiety, we use propranolol for that, right? If a person has thyroid storm, right? The first drug, the initial drug of choice in thyroid storm, right, is propranolol. Remember, it inhibits that 5' deiodinase that we find in the periphery. That's a high yield mechanism of action thing to actually know for exams, right? So we use propranolol for migraines, right? We use propranolol for many, many things on exams, right? Another classic beta blocker you may see on a test is labetalol. Remember, labetalol is an alpha beta blocker, right? Labetalol is an alpha beta blocker. It's an alpha beta blocker. We use it to treat hypertensive emergency on exams, right? It's actually one of those antihypertensives that are actually safe in pregnancy. Remember that mnemonic, hypertensive moms love nifedipine. For those antihypertensives that are safe in pregnancy, right? Hydralazine, alpha-methyl-DOPA, labetalol, and nifedipine, right? And then what else do we use beta blockers for? You can use beta blockers, right, again, to improve survival in heart failure, especially like metoprolol, carvedilol, and bisoprolol. And remember, if a person has like a pheochromocytoma, you're going to block alpha receptors first, right? You can use an alpha-1 blocker like phentolamine, right? Or phenoxybenzamine to block those alpha-1 receptors first before you then put them on a beta blocker, right? And again, remember, again, if a person comes in, they're all doped up on cocaine, right? It would be incredulous to give them a beta blocker first, right? It's only if you're looking for like unopposed alpha problems so that he can, you know, like get like a big stroke or a hypertensive crisis and die. You don't want to do that, right? So you give them an alpha blocker first before you give them a beta blocker. Although typically on NBME exams, if a person comes in with cocaine intoxication and you notice that their troponins are elevated, they have ST elevations, you basically treat them like you treat any regular MI, right? But if their blood pressure is just high, but they don't have like any severe problems, like their EKG is fine, their troponins are fine, and IV benzodiazepine is the drug of choice for those people on exams, right? But if you don't see an IV benzo, you can give them, again, something that can bring down their blood pressures like labetalol. Remember, labetalol, yes, it's described as a beta blocker, but it's an alpha beta blocker. So it's acceptable to give those kinds of people, right? So those are kind of like the big things I think I want to mention on beta blockers. Remember, you can use them in AFib, right? If a person has AFib, remember, for AFib, you can pursue like a rate control strategy or a rhythm control strategy, right? So the rate control strategy involves a beta blocker. Remember, beta blockers are class 2 antiarrhythmics, or you can use a non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker like verapamil or diltiazem. Remember, those are class 4 antiarrhythmics, right? We can use those to maintain a person's rate in AFib, right? To try to keep people in like a normal rate in AFib. And then don't forget that beta blockers, we can also use them to treat glaucoma. You know, things like pindolol, all that stuff, you can use them to treat glaucoma. Okay, I think that's all I'm going to say about beta blockers. The alpha blockers, right? So the big things with alpha blockers, remember the alpha-1 blockers, right? Like prazosin. Remember, prazosin, we can use it for the nightmares in a person that has PTSD, right? But those alpha blockers, they are pretty awesome for BPH, right? BPH, right? Although remember, they can cause orthostatic hypotension as a side effect because they are very powerful vasodilators, right? But we can use them for BPH. But if you're like, you know what, I just want to touch the person's BPH and not their hypertension, you can give tamsulosin, right? Remember, tamsulosin is an alpha-1 blocker, but it blocks the alpha-1 AD. Remember, AD as in Anthony Davis, right? You know, I'm a big Laker fan, obviously, right? So it blocks those alpha-1 AD receptors. You find those mostly in the bladder. You don't really find those in blood vessels, right? So those are kind of like the big things you use alpha-1 blockers for. Alpha-2 receptors on NBME exams, you know, there's alpha-2 blockers. Alpha-2 blockers, probably the big one you want to remember is mirtazapine. Mirtazapine, right? Remember, the alpha-2 receptor is an G-protein coupled receptor. It's an inhibitory G-protein coupled receptor, right? So when you activate it, you release less norepinephrine. So if you block it, you release more norepinephrine. That's one of the reasons why mirtazapine is awesome, right? It's an alpha-2 antagonist. It's used to treat depression, right? Remember, it causes like sedation and it causes weight gain. It actually kind of spruces up your appetite. So it's probably not a bad idea for a person that has like anorexia nervosa and they're depressed. And then don't forget, right, alpha-2 agonists, right? So stuff like clonidine. Clonidine is, it's an alpha-2 agonist, right? So it cuts down on norepinephrine release, right? So if you make less norepinephrine, that will lower your blood pressure. It's pretty good for hypertension, right? But remember, most people don't prescribe it because it causes a rebounder kind of hypertension. And remember, clonidine is also used on NBME exams for opioid withdrawal, right? Because again, if you think about it, this makes perfect sense. How do opioids work? Opioids are mu receptor agonists. Mu receptors are inhibitory G-protein coupled receptors. And we tend to find an abundance of them at adrenergic synapses, right? So if an opioid binds to a mu receptor, that actually causes less release of norepinephrine. So guess what? If a person takes clonidine, well, clonidine happens to be an alpha-2 agonist. And that alpha-2 receptor is an inhibitory G-protein coupled receptor. So you release less norepinephrine, right? So surprise, surprise. Clonidine pretty much works like an opioid. It just uses a somewhat different receptor to achieve those purposes, right? So whenever you see like opioid withdrawal power plants in hospitals, most of them pretty much always involve a clonidine. In fact, in some localities in the US, at least I remember where I went to med school, clonidine is now like a street drug in that part of the US. But what else do we use clonidine for? Right? Obviously, it's not just for hypertension. Clonidine is used a lot on psych, for whatever bizarre reason, right? So remember, It can be used to treat ADHD. It's a third line drug for ADHD. Remember, ADHD, first line, like methylphenidate, dextroamphetamine. Second line is atomoxetine. Third line, right, are your alpha 2 agonists, right, like clonidine or guanfacine, right? And then remember, clonidine, guanfacine, those alpha 2 agonists, you can also use them for Tourette's syndrome, right? You can also use them for Tourette's syndrome. Okay, and then remember your diuretics, right? Remember your loop diuretics, right? Like furosemide, right? Ethacrynic acid. Remember, furosemide is a sulfur drug. So if a person has like a sulfur allergy, ethacrynic acid is a great idea for those people. Big, big, big use of furosemide, right? It's a water pill, right? Lasix. We use it to treat peripheral edema in a person that has like nephrotic syndrome or a person that has like CHF, right? And remember that loop diuretics, right, they cause hypocalcemia, right? Remember, loops lose calcium, right? So they cause hypocalcemia, but they cause hypercalciuria. They cause hypocalcemia, but they cause hypercalciuria. So if a person has like a history of like nephrolithiasis, loop diuretics are probably not the smartest idea in the book, right? Because you're basically putting more calcium in their urine. It's almost like, you've had kidney stone before. Oh, let's give you some more, right? Again, that will not be a prudent thing to do on an MBM exam. And then don't forget that in contrast, thiazide diuretics, right, they tend to cause hypercalcemia, but hypocalciuria, right? Hypercalcemia, but hypocalciuria, right? So if a person has a kidney history of nephrolithiasis, thiazide diuretics are pretty good, right? And again, on MBME exams, they may not put HCTZ as the thiazide diuretic you may see. They may put things like metolazone, indapamide, right? Those are things that people are not used to hearing on exams, right? You want to be aware of those, right? So remember, how do loop diuretics work? Loop diuretics, they inhibit a transporter that you find at the thick ascending limb of the loop of Henle. They inhibit that sodium potassium 2 chloride transporter. I'll say that again. The sodium potassium 2 chloride transporter that we find at the thick ascending limb of the loop of Henle. And then the thiazides, they work at the distal convoluted tubule. They inhibit that sodium chloride symporter, right? They inhibit that sodium chloride symporter. Remember, between loop diuretics and thiazide diuretics actually have a stronger association with hyponatremia. Okay. And remember, taking a loop diuretic, right, is like having bladder syndrome. Taking a thiazide diuretic is like having a Gittleman syndrome, right? It's like having Gittleman syndrome. And then if you go further down in the nephron, right, especially like those, the principal cell, right? Remember the principal cell, that's where you have those potassium-sparing diuretics working, right? So we have things like amiloride or triamterene. Remember, those are INEC channel blockers. They inhibit that INEC channel that brings in sodium in the principal cell, right? Remember, primarily those drugs, you know, again, they are potassium-sparing diuretics, so obviously they'll have hyperkalemia as a side effect. But one thing you want to remember those drugs for is if a person has nephrogenic diabetes insipidus associated with lithium use, you can block those INEC channels so that lithium cannot gain entry to mess up the signaling cascade of ADH, right? And one thing I guess I suppose I forgot to mention on beta blockers is if a person like overdoses on a beta blocker and they need treatment, you need to actually go ahead and give those people a glucagon. Glucagon is the drug of choice to rescue people from beta blocker toxicity, right? To rescue people from beta blocker toxicity. Okay. And the aldosterone blockers, right? You know, I've kind of talked about them from the context of like how they're used. But don't forget that we can also, those drugs can cause a type 4 RTA basically, right? Because if you're blocking aldosterone receptors, right? It's almost like you're inducing a hypoaldosterone state, right? So those people who have a type 4 RTA. And remember, one of the key distinguishing factors on MBM exams to tell you that you're dealing with an RTA is the anion gap will be normal, right? But to tell you that, oh, this is a type 4 RTA, just check that the anion gap is normal and person has hyperkalemia. That will tell you that you're likely dealing with some kind of type 4 RTA, right? And then one other thing that is kind of like diuretic related that your friends at the MBME, they love to, you know, kind of hit on is they love to hit on the fact that many of these diuretics, right, they love to cause like they are ototoxic, right? So like your loop diuretics are ototoxic, especially ethacrynic acid. Although remember, ethacrynic acid is not associated with sulfur allergies, right? But your loop diuretics, those are ototoxic. What are the other ototoxic drugs on test, right? Cisplatin is ototoxic. Vancomycin is ototoxic. Your aminoglycosides, right? Gentamicin, tobramycin, all that stuff. Those are all ototoxic medications. Those are all ototoxic medications. And then amiodarone, right, is another nice cardiac drug you want to know about on exams. Remember, you can use it for rhythm control in a person that has AFib. You can also give it to a person that has VTAC. A person that has VTAC and is hemodynamically stable deserves amiodarone, right? Deserves amiodarone. And remember, we also use amiodarone for many of the ACLS algorithms, especially when a person has like VFib, pulseless VFib, right? Pulseless VTAC, or basically, I'll say many times you alternate amiodarone with epinephrine for many of these ACLS algorithms, right? And remember, amiodarone can cause a pulmonary fibrosis. The mechanism of action there, right, is it's a class 3 antiarrhythmic. It's a potassium channel blocker, right? It's a potassium channel blocker. Remember, in terms of the antiarrhythmics, right, we have the class 1 agents, right? Those are sodium channel blockers, right? So we have things like, I'll say probably like the biggest one to know there is procainamide. Remember, procainamide is a type 1A antiarrhythmic. It's a sodium channel blocker. Remember, we can use it for WPW. If a person has AFib with WPW, it's the drug of choice there. Don't forget that it can cause drug-induced lupus with those antihistone antibodies, right? Class 2 antiarrhythmics, those are beta blockers. I've talked about those. Class 3, those are potassium channel blockers. Big bad boy there is amiodarone. I've talked about the mechanism of action. Don't forget that amiodarone can cause pulmonary fibrosis, right? So it can cause restrictive lung disease. Remember that it can cause hypo or hyperthyroidism. It can cause skin hyperpigmentation, right? And all that stuff, right? And then class 4 are those calcium channel blockers, right? Calcium channel blockers, remember, we have the dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, right? Like amlodipine, felodipine, and all that stuff. The big thing you want to know about those drugs is that those things cause peripheral edema, right? And they can also cause constipation, right? Because basically, if you're blocking calcium channels, you're relaxing smooth muscle, especially like in your GI tract, right? But the non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers like verapamil or tiazem, those are class 4 antiarrhythmics. Remember, we can use those for AFib, right? We can use those for aflutter, right? Those drugs are also pretty good as well for migraines, right? And then don't forget, if a person has Prinz medial angina, the drug of choice for Prinz medial angina on an NBM exam is a calcium channel blocker, right? It's a calcium channel blocker. And remember that verapamil specifically can cause hyperprolactinemia. That's just one of those weird, bizarre side effects they love to test on exams. And then, there's one more thing. Yes, multifocal atrial tachycardia. If a person has MFAT, right? If a person has MFAT, remember, those people have like 3 or more P-wave morphologies. The drug of choice is not a beta blocker. It's actually a non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker like verapamil or diltiazem. Right, and then don't forget that this specific dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker, nimodipine, we can actually use that to prevent a post-stroke vasospasm, right, after a person has like a hemorrhagic stroke, right? So after a person has a subarachnoid, if you want them to not have like a vasospasm of their cerebral vessels, give them nimodipine for that purpose, right? And then don't forget digoxin. They love digoxin on NBM exams, right? How does digoxin work? Digoxin is a sodium potassium ATPase blocker, right? It inhibits the sodium potassium ATPase pump. So if that pump does not work, remember the pump, its normal job is to take 3 sodiums out of the cell and bring in 2 potassiums, right? So if that pump is not working for whatever reason, you're not going to be able to bring potassiums into cells. So guess what? Digoxin causes hyperkalemia as a side effect. I'll say that again. Digoxin causes hyperkalemia as a side effect. But the thing is, for digoxin to work, right, we said, it inhibits the sodium potassium ATPase pump. The thing digoxin does is, to inhibit that pump, it actually binds to the potassium binding site on that pump. So whenever a person is hypokalemic, there are more binding sites available on sodium potassium ATPase pumps for digoxin. So digoxin can accumulate and cause problems, right? So whenever you're hypokalemic, it makes you more susceptible to digoxin toxicity. But if you take digoxin, you can get hyperkalemia as a side effect. Make sure you understand that. I'll say that again. If you're hypokalemic, there are more binding spots available on the sodium potassium ATPase pump for digoxin to bind. So digoxin can accumulate in a person that's hypokalemic, right? So when you're hypokalemic, you are more susceptible to digoxin toxicity. But when you take digoxin, you can get hyperkalemia as a side effect. Again, maybe like Divine, there is no way they test this on NBM exams. I wish you all the best. These are things they classically test, because think about it. Who usually takes digoxin is a person that has heart failure, right? It's usually a person that has heart failure that takes dig, right? It's a person that has heart failure that takes dig. So for a person, and what do most people that have heart failure also take at the same time? They take diuretics, they take water pills, right, to help them. Most diuretics cause hypokalemia as a side effect, right? So you can already imagine a person that has heart failure, right, that starts having palpitations, prolonged QT intervals, problems with vision, like yellow vision and all that stuff, right? Abdominal pain, diarrhea, all those things. Those are all signs of DIG toxicity, right? Those are all signs of DIG toxicity. And again, remember, if a person has WPW, giving DIG is actually a bad idea as well, right? DIG is a bad idea because DIG is also a muscarinic receptor agonist, so it actually slows conduction down the AV node. And remember, you can read
Rescue a person from ditch toxicity with those anti-DEJA fab fragments, with those anti-DEJA fab fragments, right? And then I've talked about adenosine, right? Again, we use adenosine for pharmacological stress tests. And then we use adenosine as the second line measure after we've tried vagal maneuvers for a supraventricular tachycardia. Okay. Let's see. Wow, this is a 40-minute podcast already. Let me just see. I feel like I've hit on many of these high-yield drugs, although I suspect I may need to make another podcast in the future. Let's see. Is there any other cardio drug I've not really talked about that is high-yield? I mean, I'm sure there are more, but are there more that are high-yield that I've not talked about? Come on, Divine, think. Any big drugs I feel like I've not hit? I feel like I've kind of hit most of them. Oh, I guess from a cardio perspective, right? Don't forget drugs that can cause dilated cardiomyopathy, right? As side effects, trastuzumab, right? They can give you a woman being treated for breast cancer, or like adriamycin, right? Like basically your doxodonorubicin, right? Those things, those anthracyclines, those things can cause dilated cardiomyopathy. Remember myocarditis, right? Myocarditis from a drug can also ultimately lead to dilated cardiomyopathy, like clozapine, right? Clozapine is a big time drug that loves to cause myocarditis, Okay, so I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here, but let me share a quick life lesson here. This is actually kind of important, right? So, you know, I check ready periodically when, you know, whenever I have the chance and it's pretty saddening, right? Like, and if anyone hears this and knows the person that has this problem or knows the particulars of this person, please check in on them and reach out to them. But there is a person on Reddit, again, I'm putting this out publicly because this person posted on Reddit, is a med student that was thinking of pretty much ending his or her life. I don't know the sex of the person, but the person has a girlfriend in Canada. So please, if you know this person, if you're the girlfriend of this person or whatever, please reach out, please. This person posted already yesterday. This person has not responded to anyone. So I guess it's probably a he, since person has a girlfriend in Canada. Again, I don't want to assume sex here, but you kind of get my point, right? So please reach out to this person. This person has been studying for step one for like a year. Doesn't seem to have been making much of any kind of headway. So this person is thinking of ending it all, right? So please, if you know this person, if you're a friend, if you're a colleague, if you're a parent, if you're a med student, please reach out to this person. Reach out to this person. Like, that's like the big public service announcement I want to put out there, just in case anyone is listening to this. But on that note, I want to talk about mental health, right? So the thing is, I will say for sure, we definitely need mental health reforms in this country. In the US especially, I feel like our medical education system really drives many people to their wit's end from a mental health perspective. And to be honest with you, this is something I may make a podcast on in the future, like how to reform the medical education system in the US, right? But I just feel like many things, I feel like you can train great doctors, you can train excellent doctors without creating an environment that makes them mentally unstable, right? I'll give you some examples, right? Although I should maybe kind of think twice before I start speaking here because I don't want to ruffle feathers. But like one easy one I can come up with is the way people are graded in third year of med school, right? Med students, if attendings and residents knew the mental anguish med students go through just to please people, to get good evaluations, and the dirty games that many of them have to play to get good evals, you'd be surprised. I feel like that is something that can easily be remedied. I don't know, maybe like making third year also like a pass-fail system. That may not be the worst thing in the world. I feel like that will help a lot from a mental health perspective with students, but also have like some punitive measure you can put in if a student is taking advantage of that kind of system, right? And then another thing, right, with these USMLE exams, again, I have no problems with the USMLE exams, but again, I feel like there are things that can be done to not get people, like just get med students super neurotic, get them super depressed. Because basically, the way the system is designed now is a score on a test can make or mar your future, which is really unfortunate, right? Or like the pressures and rigors that, like even pre-meds go through. Because I mean, I've been on an admissions committee. If you see the problems pre-meds need to go through, like, oh,
oh, you need to take this 6-7 hour exam called the MCAT to be able to get into med school. I need to do this and this and this and this and this and this. I just feel like people that are in medicine, they almost never have any respite, right? They're pre-meds. They have to get almost like straight A's, crush the MCAT to get into med school. And then they get into med school. They have to do research. They need to crush all these exams. They need to do this. They need to do that. They need to do this. They need to do that, right? Study for unlimited hours every day to crush the exams, right? Step one is what? An 8-hour exam if you include the break time. Step two, 9-hour exam. Step three, 2-day exam, right? And then you get into residency. And then you have in-training exams. And then you're being evaluated by attendance. And then you have to take your board exams. And then you need to live up to expectations of your colleagues, of your attendants, and people are gossiping about you that, oh, you're a pro performer in residency. And then this attending to scare you and to almost like shake you down, they use the word professionalism with you. They say, oh, I'm really concerned about your professionalism, to freak out med students and all these things, or residents, just to make them like have like a fire hose under their ass. Again, I'm trying to not be angry here, but I'm just saying this. If you're involved in healthcare, look out for your fellow man. These little things you're doing, like shaking down a resident by, even if they didn't do something really bad, but let's say you want to get back at them or you want to scare them. I feel like it's like a buzzword that's used in medicine these days. If you want to shake a resident down or scare them, just slide in something. Oh, I am concerned about your professionalism, to freak them out. Brethren, that's a bad thing to do. If a person has professionalism problems, don't get me wrong. Yes, you can chastise them for that. But you don't always have to use that for every single thing that a person does. Because that word, professionalism concern, it can make a resident or a med student pee in their pants, right? And when you begin to put those kinds of things in their evaluations, you're essentially foreclosing those people's futures. So please, I'm saying this. And again, I'm saying this because, again, I know I'm just a junior person in medicine, but I'm humbly, I'm begging, I'm appealing. If you're an attending that's listening to this, if you're a resident that's listening to this, if you're a senior med student that's listening to this, if you're an admissions committee member that's listening to this, if you're involved in healthcare in any way, if you're a nurse, if you're a physician's assistant, anything, be merciful. Be merciful. Just remember that medicine, by the virtue of the way it's constructed in this country, puts people at very high risk of mental health problems. So anything you can do to look out for your fellow man, anything you can do to lessen that mental health burden, do it, right? If, for example, you see a student, you see this student is working hard, this student is doing their best, and you see that there are no patients coming in the afternoon or whatever, if you're a resident, send that med student home. You don't need to keep them there, right? Or you don't need to guilt them into like, oh, if you don't stay long, I will give you a bad eval, blah, 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 blah. No. Set clear expectations at the beginning of a rotation, like, oh, you know what? And again, I'm sorry if this podcast is taking long, but this is an important thing, because things like this, where someone has been studying for step one for a year and they are committing suicide, these things should not happen in medicine. We are people that are supposed to take care of people that have health problems. We are people that are supposed to be healers for other people. But then we're essentially eating our own young. That is not becoming of a profession, right? Like, literally, medicine has one of the highest suicide rates of any career that you'll find in any part of the world, right? Look at during this COVID thing, right? During this COVID thing, you see med schools, you see that, oh, there's, especially at the peak of COVID, we saw med schools trying to get medical students to come in. When most other med schools, AMC and everything, says, you know, these people, their rotation should be suspended. You should try to find an online option. Is that med student like super, super? Again, I know I will ruffle a few feathers on this, and I'm saying it right now, I'm sorry. But the thing is that med student super, super, super vital to the healthcare team? Like COVID and ICU or whatever. Is that med student really vital at that point? No, you can find other activities where they can help, but you don't need to put them through that thing like, oh, okay, let's say it's a class of 10 people and 2 people are going in, 8 people are not going in. And then those 8 people begin to worry, oh, what will my evaluations look like? What will this look like? What will that look like? Again, all those things are not good. And one other thing I would also say is, as a med student, try to not compare yourself with other people, right? In fact, there's a part of the Bible that says comparing themselves with themselves. When you begin to compare yourself with another person, when you begin to try to do what the other person is doing, you are setting yourself up, one, for neuroticism, and two, you're putting yourself in a high-risk place, right? You're putting yourself in a high-risk place to start getting mental health problems, right? To start getting anxious that, oh no, my classmate has matured 30,000 Anki cards, but I've not. Oh, my classmate is using all these textbooks, but I've not. No, do work hard, but do what works best for you. You don't have to do what every other person is doing. But again, the message I'll throw out here today, please, if you're involved in healthcare, just check in on your fellow man or woman. Just check in. Like if, for example, you see like a new intern, this intern is facing their first patient death, right? Touch base with the person. Sit them down. You know, tell them, you know, how about you take the afternoon off? Come, let's debrief on this thing, right? Please look out for your fellow man. If you see another person struggling, because I feel like, unfortunately, in this country, the way healthcare is set up is we're trying to outdo each person. I want to be better than this other person. I want to outdo this other person. But I'm begging you. I am please. Begging you, please, if you see someone struggling, do what you can to pull them up. Within reason, do what you can to pull them up. And med students, if you're having mental health problems, reach out to a confidential healthcare practitioner. Reach out to someone. If you need to be placed on medication, if you need psychotherapy, again, we really need psychiatrists in this country. Mental health is an epidemic, not just in this country, but in healthcare. In healthcare. So please, look out for each other, seek help, reach out to people, and, you know, just look out for your fellow man. Look out. If every med student looks out for just one or two other med students, that may alone decrease the number of suicides that are happening. Because when I read that post on Reddit yesterday, to be honest with you, my heart just dropped. I was like, wow. This is unbelievable, right? And this is not one, it's not two, it's not three. This thing happens almost every week. So please, let's look out for each other. But I am really making a call. I'm challenging med school administrators, hospital administrators, people in charge of health systems. Don't just create like some lecture. Oh, watch this lecture on wellness or do this on wellness. No. Those things, frankly, don't do squat for a person's wellness. You need to take more tangible action that will help with ensuring wellness, right? I don't even want to get started on these physician health programs. That's like another can of worms that I really don't want to open in this podcast. But those things, many times, they don't accomplish the things that they are supposedly set out to do. But I'm not gonna say more things because I feel like I've probably ruffled a ton of feathers here today. But this is an important topic. This is something we need to discuss. We cannot keep killing our young as healthcare professionals. That's just not the way life is supposed to be. So thank you for listening to this podcast. Again, my apologies that it's really long, but I think this message needs to be put out there. And I also, again, needed to talk about this person already that is basically said yesterday that they will end their lives. So if you know this person, please reach out. Share this on social media. Please reach out. This is a very, very important thing. So thank you for listening. I'll see you in the next podcast. God bless you and thank you.